Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that even if common ground is sometimes hard to find, never gives up trying to move to some sort of mutual understanding. Movement, as it were, is on the docket this week as we tackle a pair of movies that address the disparate meanings of that word. Bullet Train, which stars Brad Pitt as one of half dozen or so assassins fighting to the death on a Japanese train, is the epitome of an actual physical journey. But the documentary film Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey, A Song, is much more of a philosophical exploration. Let's begin then with a bit of Asian locomotion. Like a number of other action-packed studies of comic violence, think of the Guy Ritchie film Snatch and Martin McDonagh's Seven Psychopaths, director David Leitch's adaptation of Japanese author Kotaro Isaka's 2010 novel Maria Beetle is a mostly frenetic study of quip-heavy characterization and ample examples of bloodletting. Oh, there's a backstory, something about betrayal and revenge involving a villain played by Michael Shannon, cutely called White Death. But it takes a back seat to the way characters address each other. Brad Pitt plays a sensitive, somewhat self-aware assassin named Ladybug. Yes, the film is full of cute names, who is after the obligatory MacGuffin, in this case a briefcase, but must fight off a half dozen or so other killers to fulfill his mission. Pitt is nowhere near as good here as he was as a mumble-heavy, self-described pikey in Snatch. But overall, Bullet Train is just the kind of summer actioner that will put a smile on the face of most movie fans, who will then keep it in mind just about as long as it takes to exit the theater.
Let's be clear, when we're talking about Bullet Train, I think that Manola Dargis of the New York Times may have said it best when she characterized this as a giddily violent bummer. And so that sort of captures various aspects of Bullet Train. Dan, you were right when you told us that this is about a journey, and we need to give you major props for trying to link the themes of Bullet Train and Hallelujah, because that was a stretch, but you managed to do it nicely. So what are the good things about Bullet Train, and what are some other things? I think that the good thing about Bullet Train, in my opinion, is the cast. Brad Pitt, you know, I think he plays it well. He said he's going to give up acting, but, you know, he's still an action hero, so to speak, in this particular film. We start off with the two British assassins, played by Brian Tyree Henry of Atlanta fame and Aaron Taylor Johnson. And they sort of engage in this witty repartee at the beginning of this film, and it didn't quite work for me. I think they were trying to emulate or simulate some of the Pulp Fiction buddy movie sort of feel, and it didn't quite work, although each of their characters grew on me as time went on. It takes place on this bullet train, and I think that the director does use that to its advantage because it's a multi-car train, and each of the individual cars has sort of a different theme. There's a quiet car, there's a kid's car with these Japanese cosplay anime characters writ large and so forth. So it's really, as you point out, Dan, really not so much about a story as it is about these interactions among these characters. And I think that you mentioned Michael Shannon, Joey King shows up, Zazie Beetz, and I don't know, it's clever, but not clever enough. And I guess that's my major disappointment about Bullet Train. It is a summer blockbuster. I'm not that familiar with the director, who I think is actually a stuntman, started his movie career as a stuntman. You know, there are some little vignettes within this film that work really well, and others, not so much.
Well, David Leitch, the director of Bullet Train, also did a movie called Atomic Blonde with Charlize Theron, which I actually like quite a bit. I mean, it was this empty but super stylish beat-em-up kind of movie with these big, ridiculous set pieces. And this movie, Bullet Train, is kind of doing the same thing, but this one didn't work for me. I'm glad you mentioned Pulp Fiction, because I thought about Tarantino all the way through this. I mean, this is like sub-Tarantino, and it reminds me of all of these movies that came out, not after Pulp Fiction, but after Kill Bill, these kind of smug, self-aware action comedies like Shoot 'Em Up or Smoke and Aces or Lucky Number 11, all those movies that everyone remembers so fondly. And I was also thinking of Guy Ritchie. You mentioned Snatch, Dan, and I thought of Guy Ritchie all the way through this, and Edgar Wright, and even just talk like going into Asian directors that have done this style, Beat Takeshi and Takashi Miike and Stephen Chow. And, you know, the Japanese setting of this, too. I know that this movie is getting some flack and criticism because of its use of Japan. And I don't want to say that it's offensive, because I certainly don't go to a movie like Bullet Train for cultural sensitivity. But it's just, it's so lame and obvious, this whole, like, isn't Japanese culture so weird and quirky? And you've got the anime characters and the electronic toilets. It just feels like, it doesn't feel like a movie from 2022. It just feels like it's so lazy and old-fashioned, but not in a charming way. I was surprised that this novel that it's based on came out in 2010, because I would have assumed it was way older. I agree, there are some amusing gags here and there. And there was a stretch near the beginning of this movie as they were setting all the characters up. And there's kind of this cutaway gag where the two assassins can't remember how many guys they've killed. And you see a quick succession of all of the crimes they've committed. I thought, oh, this might be kind of fun. But then this movie goes on for 2 whole hours. And it's really difficult to make a movie in a single location, even though, as you said, there are all these different cars that they go to. It's a one location movie, and it gets real tiresome after 2 hours, I thought. And Brad Pitt's kind of self-aware act, this idea that there's all this mayhem happening around him, but he responds with this kind of, you know, ironic detachment. It's kind of like Deadpool, which David Leitch directed one of the Deadpool movies. That got really tiresome for me. So I think if this had been like a tight 85-minute movie with maybe half the plot, because we haven't even gotten into how convoluted this plot becomes, they could have had something here, and I could have overlooked some of the problems. But because I spent so much time on this bullet train, I started overthinking all of these things. And so I just kind of grew really tired of it. And for a movie to have a late third act reveal that involves Michael Shannon, who I love unconditionally, and for me not to be on this movie side all the way, they were doing something wrong, I think.
Well, unlike you, I did appreciate what Brad Pitt was doing. I just really like this guy. He brings something to a movie. I'm not going to say he's the best actor ever, and he won an Academy Award for a movie in which he self-admitted that he basically just took his shirt off and, hey, let's give him an Academy Award for that. But he brings a presence to a film, and I just like his playing against type here. It reminded me much more of the character he played in the Ocean 11 movies, in which he eats his way through those entire films. I think it's silly to hold films like this up to some sort of standard in which they're commenting on culture, because, you know, that's the whole point of a film like this, is it's going to take shots and it's going to make fun of everything and everybody. I keep thinking back to what Pitt did in Guy Ritchie's film Snatch, in which, you know, he played one of those travelers, you know, in Brittany, and they totally make fun of those. And I don't remember anybody ever complaining about that. Then it's because it's a minority group, and it's fun to make fun of gypsies or travelers, whatever. But oh my God, we can't make fun of the Japanese. You know, I'm really getting really tired of that. Can't we just look at these movies and just basically say, look, there's no overt racism here. There's no overt sexism. Women have a place. These films are filled with diverse characters. Can't we just have fun making fun of humanity?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, this is like an international thriller, right? So, you know, you've got people from, it's probably more of a selling tactic than anything else, because you've got, you know, actors from every country. My problem with it is that there are almost no Japanese characters in this at all until near the end of the movie. They're almost completely absent. And at least Tarantino, when he was doing his martial arts homage in the first Kill Bill movie, you know, he brought out people like Sonny Chiba, and, you know, he had all these great callbacks to, you know, martial arts movies of the past. I just think this movie, it's low hanging fruit. It's just, it's obvious stuff. It's obvious jokes. That was my problem with it.
Trust me, I'm not arguing that. This is not among these kinds of films. You know, I mean, I rate films like Snatch and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels far above anything that Bullet Train has.
But I think that's part of the problem with this film. It was at least trying to be more, I think. Like, they had all these flashback sequences so that to provide context for the characters. And I was like, okay, that's mildly interesting, but really, who cares? I mean, and so I think it was sort of betwixt and between, as my grandmother would have said.
And what is Sandra Bullock doing in this movie? I mean, she comes on at the very end and it looked like she was photoshopped into the film.
Well, we have a couple of cameos in here that were not funny.
Well, the cameos aren't funny in themselves. It's supposed to be funny that there's a cameo. Like, it's just a really, like, one level thing. I guess I won't spoil the other ones, but your mileage may vary on those.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, that was our dissembling of Bullet Train. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the documentary Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey, A Song. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101. I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Bullet Train. Let's now move to the documentary Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey, A Song. When he presented his album Various Positions to Columbia Records in 1983, Leonard Cohen was disappointed when the company turned it down. So was John Lesueur, who produced the LP. Lesueur is one of the many Cohen colleagues, fans, and or friends who is quoted in the documentary co-directed by Daniel Geller and Dana Goldfein, which focuses on the one song from that album, maybe the one song from Cohen's lengthy career, that became a true classic, Hallelujah. Though it took a while, both Various Positions finally to be released by another smaller company, and for Hallelujah to catch public attention, it finally did. Musicians such as John Cale and Jeff Buckley covered the song, arguably better than Cohen did, and that, with help from the DreamWorks film Shrek featuring Cale's version, made all the difference. The documentary explores both the song's synthesis and the artistic concerns from which it was born. Cohen likely didn't know he was penning a tune for all time, but one of the great ironies of life is sometimes that's exactly how the greatest art is created.
Yeah, I like this approach of taking an artist's legacy and career and kind of distilling it down into one piece of their discography or output. I was trying to think of other documentaries that did similar things. I'm sure there are some I'm forgetting, but I thought of the movie that's about Psycho and Hitchcock, but is specifically about the shower scene in Psycho and analyzes it frame by frame. And it really gets you into the entire movie that way. And that's kind of what they're doing here with Hallelujah. They're showing how he worked on this song off and on for like 7 or 8 years. He just kept coming back to it. It was clearly an obsession for him. And then to have this thing that you've worked on and put all of your, you know, feelings about spirituality into it, and then to have it basically be rejected and then come raging back again later on. I mean, it's such a great trajectory, and it makes total sense that they would focus on this. And this one, Hallelujah, this documentary is the third documentary I can think of that I have seen about Leonard Cohen. So nothing in this was new or surprising to me. But if you aren't really a fan, and I am, especially going back, I mean, I think those first few Leonard Cohen records, like Songs of Leonard Cohen and Songs of Love and Hate, I think are amongst the best singer-songwriter albums ever. If you're not a fan, this is probably a pretty good place to start. I do have to say that I do like the song Hallelujah, and I think that Jeff Buckley's version is probably the definitive version. And he was covering John Cale, covering Leonard Cohen. So it's a cover of a cover. But I don't know. I think there is such a thing as maybe hearing a song too many times. And Leonard Cohen is even in a Talking Head interview saying, maybe people should take a break from singing Hallelujah for a while, because even he had heard it too many times. So yeah, I don't know. It's a good song. But by the end, I was like, maybe I have heard Hallelujah 10 or 12 too many times for my liking. But it did make me want to go back and listen to those early Cohen recordings, which are my favorites.
I don't think you can ever have too much Hallelujah. I'm just saying. I mean, and I like the fact that he got Talking Heads from various aspects of, you know, not only Leonard Cohen's life, but major recording stars today. So, and I thought maybe one of the most moving segments was Eric Church and his concert at Red Rocks, because, you know, that's not necessarily the crowd that you would automatically think would gravitate toward this music. And he said he sang it, you know, for the first time, and he was himself was just blown away by the sort of reverence of what was happening. I liked the fact that they deconstructed the different aspects of it, because I think that, you know, there's the religious aspect, so to speak, that is in keeping with Cohen's sort of coming of age as a conservative Jew in Montreal. And then there's the more secular versions. And then there's the Shrek version with the naughty parts left out. So I appreciated learning more about that.
Well, and I should probably say that as a millennial, I think the first time I heard the song was probably in Shrek, which is embarrassing. But I mean, and I think the movie does make a pretty compelling case that this song, and particularly its use in that movie, led to his late career resurgence. Talking about the deconstruction of the lyrics, I like that too. I wish that this movie had done more to deconstruct it as a song, because it deconstructs it thematically, but it never, like, they don't have any music theorists or academics come in and say, this is why I think this song resonates. It doesn't really get into that. And so I think that could have been a really, I'm interested in that stuff. So maybe it's, you know, a selfish pursuit, but I think that could have been an interesting element.
A nice addition. Academic, always a nice addition.
Yeah, I agree with you, Nathan. I think they could have cut out a little bit of the first half of his biography and everything. They do make the point that his career progressed in a certain way, that it culminated basically in this song. This song basically represents pretty much everything that he was trying to do, but they could have cut that out. They intentionally stayed away from any sort of line by line reading because they wanted to keep it, you know, mysterious. They wanted to talk about an artist never tries to explain his art, which I thought was a little bit disingenuous, but I wish they had done just a little bit more of that.
Well, the thing that I liked is, I mean, you could see so many different incarnations of this particular piece. And so when you have a work that's iconic, even if it was not recognized as such early on, and then you see all of these different people do it in varied ways. And I think you're right. I think that the probably John Cale, Jeff Buckley, I like Rufus Wainwright's version, but you know, we saw these other people doing it. We saw groups doing it. And I think that's really his legacy, that whatever it is about the musical piece of it resonates for people. And I think that's what you're concerned about, is we didn't really find out what is about that combination of notes and music and timing that is so universal.
it's such a nebulous thing too. And that's one of the challenges of writing about music. It's, you know, the dancing about architecture joke that everyone talks about, is that our response to music is, I think, for those people that don't understand music theory necessarily, who don't understand like the mathematics of it, it is a knee-jerk response. Like you hear a song, you just love it because you love it. And so that can be a difficult thing to get into. And I think the movie...
those concert excerpts from all over the globe. And so there's something universal.
That
people in Southeast Asia and the Nordic countries and Africa and Keokuk, Iowa, you know, can relate to.
Well, and it's interesting to me too, because the original version of this song, the one that's on Various Positions, Leonard Cohen's original arrangement of this, I have never liked. I really don't like the original recording of Hallelujah. I think it's actually, of all the versions that you hear in the movie, it's clearly the worst. And I think that Cohen, even after he recorded it, he kept modifying the song and he kept changing it. And then you hear him performing it in concert near the end of his life, and it sounds like a totally different song than it did on the record. I mean, the record is so spare and almost electronic, and it's really strange. And there's a couple good songs on that album, but his original version of Hallelujah is not my favorite. So I find it fascinating that it has that malleability that we heard, you know, people like Jeff Buckley and Rufus Wainwright completely change it down the line.
One of the most moving, Murray Pat already talked about this, one of the most moving renditions that I heard in this film was by Brandi Carlile, and her explanation of what the song meant to her and how it helped her accept her way in life and her way of being in the world. It brought me close to tears. It was really very moving. And I didn't want to close this out without referring basically back to what you were talking about, Nathan. If you want to go back to Leonard Cohen, when I got out of the Army in 1969, I'm a couple of generations removed from you. I spent many afternoons listening to the songs of Leonard Cohen. Suzanne is a song that I just absolutely loved. And you need to go back and listen to him there. That was the greatest stuff. And this is a decent way to start, as you said, Hallelujah, seeing Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey of Song. At any rate, that was our discussion of Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey of Song. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder and Murray Pat Truthart and I discussed the action film Bullet Train. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the dancer, choreographer Martha Graham. All that is important is this one moment in movement. Make the moment important, vital, and worth living. Do not let it slip away unnoticed and unused. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.